I guess we should still recap. That, what do we, oh, now you're back. Okay, I'm confused. So, okay, so we will go to the Fermion summarizing our Feynman rules second thing today. Is I just have one more little thing to say. Then we can summarize all the Feynman rules. So we'll just recap what we did yesterday. What we did yesterday is we tried to quantize EM field covariantly for no apparent purpose except it's mathematically cute. And then we realized, of course, we have to impose the gauge condition somehow. And there is this Gupta-Loipa condition. It's basically the best thing we can do, because the better things than that is impossible. But the most important result from that is we got the photon propagator. Which is basically your, sorry, I think I read a mass term yesterday. It's the scalar propagator that you are familiar with, except now that it has this metric, because the photon propagator, after all, is the time order of two photons. And if this definition has index, your result should have index. This is the momentum space. It's just like, I mean, that's all we tried yesterday, is try to utilize Klein-Gordon, what we learned from Klein-Gordon theory as much as possible, such that we can write down a propagator in one line, because you say, well, it's for Klein-Gordon theory. So the only thing we're missing is some tensor index to match with the propagator. So, well, we said, and we also see that how we can define physics states. I guess I should write down this condition. So it says that you split it into the minus and the plus, and the annihilation, the one has annihilation operator, will annihilate the physics state, and the other half will be annihilated by the other half. So this is the known as the Gupta Loipa condition. Yeah, so now we have photon quantized. Remember last time we finally quantized the fermions, we immediately say now we have fermions and the scalars, let's see how they interact. And this is the same thing, now we have photons, we should make them interact. After all, only interacting theory is interesting. If it's a free theory, we know what we do, what the particles do, they just follow the geodesic. Okay, so, but we have seen the interaction between light and matter already. We have written down the Lagrange. Yeah, we did? So, quantum electrodynamics. So what we did is that, remember what we say is that, hey, we spotted this cute bilinear. Says, huh, what kind of terms can we write down? Well, this bilinear, gamma mu themselves are just numbers, but this bilinear actually transforms with as a vector. So it makes sense to write to give it another vector, and then this term would be Lorentz invariant, hence should be allowed. And this is indeed allowed. This is the quantum electrodynamics. This is the interaction between fermions and the photons. Yeah? And then we're like, oops, the emu has this gate symmetry, and this term doesn't look at all that respect the gauge symmetry at all. And then we realize, don't worry, if the Poisson also transform, maybe together the full Lagrangian will you do something, then the gauge symmetry would be respect. Yeah? We remember that little not very long derivation is that we claim that this guy transform with a divergence, and this guy transform as a E minus alpha E minus Q alpha of X. And then it will work, and it fix the coupling constant. Like, this term can only show up in the Lagrangian in a very certain way, otherwise this symmetry, this gauge symmetry wouldn't respect. And we realize we can use a fun trick. So if we define the covariant derivative is equals to this guy, then writing down interaction is very simple. You just replace the partial derivative with the covariant derivative. And of course, we should write the free Maxwell theory Lagrange. So this is known as QED Lagrange. Yeah, you have seen this already. We should always have the free theory over there. And now what's left to do is to read off the Feynman rules. Well, I don't fancy to go through all the LSC reduction formula again, but if you do, I can find some references. So, well, we can profit, right? Because this is, in our mind, just for Klein-Gordon field. Okay, so let's first look at the vertex Feynman rule. Vertex Feynman rule normally is simple. You just look at the interacting Lagrangian, and then you put an I in front. Let's see what kind of thing we have now. Let's only look at the interaction. The interaction is given by Poisson bar and I, and there is also IQ A mu. And then I shouldn't forget that the gamma mu is hidden in the slash, and now there is another percent. So the only thing I did is I plug d mu into this and read it off. And throw the free Lagrangian away because we already derived their Feynman rules. So, well, there is minus q psi bar a mu gamma mu psi. So in the Feynman rule language, they say there is a fermion, and then there is a photon. Photon is always represented by these lines. It's only when you learn about gluons that I become very confused which photon, which is photon, which is gluon. They all look wavy, but they wave in a different way. Okay, so our task is to find this vertex. And the recipe is put an I in front of that thing. So I think it shouldn't surprise you that much. I'll write minus IQ. The question is that it? So let's think about it, about the Feynman rules. Whenever we are trying to read off Feynman rules, we always think about what actually LSC accomplished for us. In one sentence, what LSC accomplished for us is that the scattering amplitude is some time-ordered field operator's vacuum expectation with a bunch of operator acting on it, right? So the idea is that our way of calculating the amplitude is try to utilize the fact if I just have a time-ordered field operators, a bunch of them, eventually you can just use weak theorems and I'll contract them away and use propagators. It's all propagators, which means we can only throw the field in. Anything that is not a field, sticking between them, we should take them out. They should belong to the expansion coefficient of the Taylor expansion. So this is the only tricky part about a QED, is your Feynman rule actually come with a gamma matrix, which makes sense. Think about that a photon, it does carry an index. So we're gonna derive scalar QED. I heard that David also promised you guys something. Says, Gun, we'll talk about scalar QED. Okay, we're gonna do this little exercise by finding the interaction rule, interaction Lagrangian, and read off the vertex in the afternoon too for scalar QED. But this is the only tricky part, is that the only thing you want to be left, which get sandwiched in those vacuum state, is the field operator. And if it's anything else, it goes to the rule. So this will be like important again in QFT2 when you learn more complicated theories. Well, it works all the same, except it become more complicated. But that's the rule, because that's how we derive it. We only want field operators in our expectation value. So, well, that wasn't hard. So let's briefly take a look at what happens. I'll just be lazy and take half of it. Say, this guy is given by U, which depends on P, and has this index, and then it comes with a operator, and then has this index, and then it is that. And then we compare this with the A mu minus, which is epsilon has come with mu, and there are four of them. So then it comes with a quantization where there's also four of them, and it's depend on P. This typically depend on P. And then, so I'm just comparing these things and realize so let's just try to think about it. Where is the external line rule come from? The external line rule come from something like finding some integral of operators, and then what is, you get some Dirac operator, but who cares? They all get canceled. What's important is what is left. Like when you read all Feynman rules from a mode expansion, what is important is actually not the Dirac operator, because that's what you expect. And it's what's left that's important. That's why that the scalar field has external leg one, because there's nothing left. So which means, I hope it's not surprising that if I say there is a photon and the coming in to this vertex, the Feynman rule will just be the whatever is in front. And because if I use lambda and I have to, so it is normally just marked as it's the incoming photon polarization. It's a notation that it's clear because photon, unlike fermions, they don't have arrows on them. And then, so now if we have a photon coming out of the vertex, it's just the outgoing photon's polarization. It's just whatever is in front. Because this polarization vectors, they are just a bunch of real numbers. Even if you dagger this, it's a real field, so there's no complication. And then we're just using in and out to point it out. It's whatever the external states that provide us.
Shouldn't there be a transpose? Because
that's probably true. Yeah, I think that the transpose is just big. So because this is just one of them and it's a four vector, it's just when you write down like a p mu, p mu, you don't write the transpose anymore. It's just two four vectors. So the transpose is denoted by where the mu is. The mu is upper, then it's transpose.
You need a column and a row, right? To make the multiplication defined.
Okay. Yeah, you're probably right. I'm not thinking. Yes.
I have a question. I'm just wondering why the polarization should be real. Looks like in the condition we have.
What do we have is this condition. That's the only condition we have on these four vectors. And remember, we can choose a special frame, and you can choose a special set of polarization vector, which is just 1, 0, 0, 0, 1.
Okay, so it's just
but then you to get the general one, you just do Lorentz transformation on them. And the Lorentz transformation wouldn't introduce complex. Everybody happy? If everybody is happy, then I can continue writing down all the Feynman rules we have seen so far. Well, not the scalar ones. The scalar ones has a bunch of one, and then it depends on the interaction term. So, okay, so we'll forget about a scalar for in the morning. In the afternoon, they'll come back into the story. Now we're just going to review all the Feynman rules in fermion theory. Because I'm going to ask you guys to draw Feynman diagrams and write down matrix element. And it'd be nice if the rules are just on the board, you can just look. And of course, if when you look and there are thoughts in your head to ask where they come from, that's also nice. But let's do this thing. So there is a vertex and there's a fermion coming in. So that tells us it's a fermion. This tells me it's coming in. And then this is given by incoming fermion is given by some polarization that a spin label that I don't know. It would depend on the three momentum vector. Yeah, it's all the rules we derived together. I'm just putting on the board so that that there is a reference. Okay, you might get bored of seeing me writing all the rules that we derived. So now you can practice interview by thinking about a popular question I would ask is why the incoming fermion is U and the incoming antifermion is V bar. And I'll continue murmuring about the Feynman rules. So here is, say I would ask why this one comes with bar. And now there is an outgoing fermion. There's a small arrow for momentum. And this one is U bar. And of course, can write one for antifermion. So those are the external leg rule, well, the interaction rule, the vertex rule is here. This is the vertex rule we're going to use today. And then there are some minor signs says that if one diagram switch odd number of labels on external fermion legs and then look like another, a minus sign popping out. And we know this minus sign, they are originally coming from the weak contraction. That you have to swap things. So minus signs as you have all, I think most of you guys submit the homework, they all originally from the anti-commutator. And some of them go a little bit more detail, but then it's basically there's commutator, so normal ordering, there's minus sign, time ordering, there's minus sign. Weak contraction, the thing we do is basically exchange things in the time ordering, so more minus sign. And then we find that there is actually a Feynman rule for it. It says indeed you can recover minus signs just by staring at the Feynman diagram. It's not so enlightening why this is faster than doing weak contraction, but you do have, you know, one loop, two loops. Many loops. So, and then this result is important, is that if there is a fermion loop, there is a minus sign. It's not a tricky thing. If you just draw a fermion rule, and then you write down fermion loop, you write down the fermion propagator, yeah.
This minus sign, so this is in reference to another diagram, right?
Right.
So
relative.
Pick one to be positive, basically.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what we do. You just have to pick one, and if there is many, then you all respect to that guy. Because overall, you're going to do square it. So overall minus sign doesn't matter. Just pick one, and the relative minus sign do matter because we can actually measure. Okay, so this should be all the Feynman rules. While I'm preparing for the next part of you, you can always stop me and tell me that I forget something. I hope I didn't. Oh, where's the propagator? Oh, they did, what? Oh, here's the propagator, but I didn't draw one. Here. And there's a mu index here, u index. All right. Oh, fermion propagator. Apparently I threw away all the propagator for some reason. This is not a good. So this time I could even write it nicely, says they actually come with an index too, just like the photon propagator. It's just we always subtract the fermion propagator. But if I keep it around, in momentum space, it will give us this. Yeah? Ooh, AB. Because that is slash carries, which makes sense. If you have any field that has more than one component, go to any other field, has one more, the same component. The only propagator we're calculating is from one specific component to the other specific component. Are we ready? Oh, I'm not ready. Which bag? I have many bags. Okay, so now I kindly ask you to, yes.
So the propagator doesn't distinguish between whether it's a fermion or an antifermion?
Yes, it does. So it should have an error on it. But and then when you follow the fermion line inversely, you just write this. Yeah, you are very correct. This arrow is important. Like, no, that's a very, very important thing. So you draw your Feynman, diagram, the arrow should be always pointing to one direction and become a line that has arrows and then no flipped arrows. Yeah.
So why isn't there an I epsilon?
I.
The mass I.
Yeah. To be very correct, I should write this.
The denominator, though?
Oh, yeah, there should be the I epsilon. Sorry, it's just when you calculate the matrix element square, that the epsilon never really matters in calculation. It's just really good for to understand how to draw the contour and have it. But yes, of course it is. Any more questions? If you don't have more questions, can you move close to each other in some fashion such that three of you guys form a loop? Like at least make some agreement. Make some agreement such that there's three. Oh, no, I think we exactly have, there is three, the person, Honam, can you move forward? I think there were two people here. So now we have exactly mod 3 equals 0. This is non-trivial. I only get this 33% time, right? Yeah, no, you have blank paper. So can you just pass the blank paper around? And I have more things to pass around. Yeah, that'd be great. Well, I think you would like to do this part. Look what I have. Anyway, just pass them around. And also each person can get one. And I'll do the other part. So, unfortunately, your tutorial is not blank. Yeah, I know, you could hope so. Okay, I'm just gonna write things on board while explaining what's going on. I should label them.
Elise, do we have another one?
So, what are we going to do is a process. So, wait, I'll first propose the alternative thing. So I hope you will like this a little bit better. So the alternative thing is that I will write down all the process, draw all the Feynman diagram, write down all the matrix element on the board and make a bunch of mistakes. And somehow I feel that you might get bored to death if I do that. But if you want to watch me do it, I can hopefully do it. But it's much better for you guys to do it. So there are some specific instructions to follow. Is that first, so the idea is that, so every person will do three things. Every person, that's equivalent. But the step one is to roll a die to determine a dice, right? Dice. Okay, roll a dice and determine which one is your process. And also, I need a blank paper. I don't have blank paper. Where is blank
paper? Oh, shit. Next.
Can you have, what, where is the leftover blank paper? Oh, can I get one of you give me a blank paper? No. You, each of you will need one. So, it's not step two. Write your process on the number of your process, like on this crease. I just learned the word yesterday. So write this crease and fold it so that nobody except yourself knows about this process. Yeah? Yeah, everybody is on step two. That's all I need. Okay. And you should know your process. No, you cannot roll the die. You shouldn't change the die roll decision. Just roll a die, and that's your process. And step three is to draw the Feynman diagram. And then the next step is to hide your diagram. No. Show your diagram and pass to one direction or two independent directions. I don't care. Pass to the left or right. Agree upon the group. But after you agree, you should push pass on the same direction. Agree a direction and pass it. And then the next step would be the person would be looking at the diagram, pick one diagram, because normally there are more than one. Pick one and then write down the amplitude. So the person should only looking at the Feynman diagram, but not knowing what's the process, but regardless, should write down the amplitude, and then you pass again. And the seventh step is the best. You should guess the process. And then when we pass again, it should be back to yourself, and then you should check if they guess right. So every step, well, you could make a very interesting amount of mistakes such that somehow it still get back. But of course, the idea is that you would only get the process back if everybody did it right. Okay?
Up to which order?
Yeah.
What do you mean up to?
You know, two vertices,
1 million vertices. How many loops? I don't know.
Tree level. We will have fun with loops this afternoon. Some fun. Until that it's not fun anymore, then we don't draw them. Tree level. So, I hope that the people have more experience with drawing QED diagram and writing down their matrix elements. And we'll take a 5-minute break. And of course, you're welcome to continue discussing about how to write down QED matrix elements.
Right. And it just comes down to writing down a bunch of for me, because the inputs are going to be whatever we have used.
And at 10, we will figure out, now that I have the matrix element, how do I actually find something that I can give to experimentalists? So the last step, connecting the matrix element to the cross section. So at 10, now you can, well, it's the 5-minute break, you can do whatever you want. And I see people's enthusiasm about cross sections. Coffee? Cross sections. Okay, no. It's their choice. Okay. So as I said before the break, that now we're going to make the final step towards the cross section, which I see people are not enthusiastic about it, but that is the thing we can show experimentalists, and they can actually compute. They can do experiment to check if a theory is correct or not. So it's very important. Otherwise, we can just write down random interaction Lagrangians and don't know if they are there or not. So, how do we get a cross section? There is a lot of something called phase space integration, blah, blah. But the most important thing is this matrix square thing. So remember in bosonic theory, well, that's not too hard because you have a function. Now you might have more than one function. You just add them up and square it. And okay, let's try to make this more enthusiastic that your homework is calculate one of this for this process. Okay, so I'll just point out a couple pit trap that you might fall in when calculating this. So I'll demonstrate how to calculate one of them. And you were like, why don't you just calculate this? Nope, that's not what I'm going to do. Instead, I'll make the life more interesting by introducing another fermion. So we have some QED Lagrangian. Let's see, we could, why not? It's around being observed. It's actually very important. You, in all kinds of experiment, is that they look at the muons. Muon is just like electron, except it's heavier. Because it's heavier, it decay to electron. But if you look at the cosmic ray, lots of them, because you know relativity thing, time gets slower, so they don't decay immediately. So this thing definitely exists, observed. And we should do this. That's exactly what we're going to do in the tutorial is we learned different aspects of theory. We isolated different interaction. There's some scalar field. They self-interact a lot. And then they interact with fermions through this Yukawa. Then they interact in the QED way. QED talk about the fermions and the photons. But in principle, the reality is they are all there. You write down Lagrangian. If you look at the standard model Lagrangian, which in some way you can fit on the t-shirt, there are many terms. What we did was very, you know, toy model-ish. We're like, let's just look at this term. So this process in real life will occur. And the reason I'm doing it is, of course, that I'll just draw the Feynman diagram with some photons, with some other fermions, and there's E. And then there is this. Mu minus is a real fermion. This one is not a fermion. So the reason I'm doing this is there is only one diagram. And a hint, the one that you are going to do for the homework, for the final homework, there are two diagrams. So you will actually experience the idea of interference between two diagrams. But you know, you square like A plus B, you get the three terms. This term is done today. In your homework, you literally can just can say that this term is done, this is the result. But you have to calculate the other. Well, you have, yes.
There's no interaction between the Dirac field and the moon field? Or is there? I mean, because...
Well, yeah, there is, but it's not a QED. So you, if you go further down the standard model path, there is. But there's no way you can smash this and this together in QED. There is some thing called the Lapton number. So only weak interaction will change which type of fermion you are. So that's why I want to do this calculation, because that tells me that I only need to do one term. But the doing more than one term is not hard. So now I have to write down the matrix element. So let me pick this muon line and follow it in the opposite direction. I see a muon, which is U bar S1. I'll skip the, well, I'll not skip the moment. And then the next thing I see is a vertex. So I write down minus IQ gamma mu. And then I see the outgoing antifermion. So it's actually less tricky than that. You're like antifermion, and then I have to make it Lorentz invariant. So you know antifermion is V, and bars contracted with number. So you only need to figure out one half, and the other half, you just look at it, what kind of fermion it is. So this shouldn't be terribly different from what you have if you have the electrons and positrons. So I'll just actually write down the belong to the muon. And then I encounter a photon propagator. So that's minus I e eta mu nu p square. I'll figure out what's p later. And then there is another line that if I follow inversely, I see a positron. So it better be V and it better be a bar, because that's my starting of a, another Lorentz invariant thing. So there's some S3. I guess I'm picking the momentum as I go. That might not be the best idea. Okay, no label means electron, labeled means muon. I guess what I picked is P1, P2, P3, P4. Okay, I strongly suggest you guys pick the momentum before start writing down the matrix element. This is not a good habit. Sorry. Okay, so we have this giant thing. And P, well, since I'm having the incoming particles, incoming things being together, so I'll replace it by this guy. Yeah. Now we want to square this. And it doesn't sound fine, is it? But unfortunately, this is a required scale for people who have taken QFT1. Actually, sometimes it's a lot earlier, the scale training. Okay, so the calculation, so what I can do now is square this dude. Okay, let's take out the interaction. This part is easy, they're just better, so there's another I. But the I doesn't matter that much, you're gonna square. Okay, so there's a bunch of I's because I have only one term. I'm totally not caring what happens to that bunch of I's. I'm doing a modular square thing. What I care is there's a Q square. Now it'll become a Q to the fourth. And then downstairs, there is some kinetic term. Yeah? So this is something not hard. I'm just squaring things. And what becomes complicated is when we square this guy. So it's clear that there is an eta here, so this gamma mu is just going to contract with this gamma. That's also clear. What's unclear, and what is I'm doing here, is trying to figure out what happened to this thing. The index. Okay, I'll keep down. Mu 4. Okay, how do I square this? Well, actually, we do the usual thing. We find the complex conjugate of this thing. So this thing, since I'm only finding the complex conjugate, I'll just strip off all these decorations, and I can put them back because the 4 is apparently go with U, the 3 is go with V bar. I'm just saying, what is this? And this, you actually know what it is, because I know what the U dagger is. I know what the gamma mu dagger is. Oh, it's a distance past, but you definitely applied this trick a few times. And what that's bar means there is a gamma zero, but a gamma zero dagger is just gamma zero. Then now we have the V dagger. After dagger, it'll be V. Yeah.
We're gonna like sum over the spinner indices at some point. Don't we want to do that before taking the magnitude, or does it not matter?
We will. We will. At this point, I'm not obliged to yet. It will come up soon, very soon. So spinner index is summed. See, this is A, there's AB, and there's B.
Okay, so I'm...
It's those, it will come up in like 4 minutes, something.
Are you using these switched for muons, or am I seeing things?
I'm taking this guy. Sorry. They are... I'm doing for this.
Regardless of what you're doing right now. Because if we follow the fermion line for muons, we start with the anti-muon, right?
No, that's the muon.
Oh, we follow you up. Oh. Yeah, sorry. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, this is the first day you do it. This. Okay. So... Then you realize Aha! Isn't this nice? He just literally flipped and the bar and the not bar just followed at the right place. Questions?
I think we're a little confused, like why you would just take this half separately.
Ah, okay. So let's restore this spinner index. Sorry, writing the wrong one is not going to help me. So this is like a not a matrix. So this part alone is not a matrix. This part alone is not a matrix.
But what about the space-time index? What about the space-time index? Isn't that still a problem?
Oh. You mean the mu and nu? Yeah, okay. You have a good point. Well, we'll just have to figure out how that works. So, I shouldn't do that. So if now we forget about the spinner index, we'll get another copy of that. So, okay, you're right. This index might not be right. So how about we do this? Let's first look at what happens to squaring this guy. So remember the spinner index and the space-time index are completely separate things. So I'm going to treat them separately. And the only thing carry the space-time index is this thing. And if I want to square this, I just get another copy of it. So basically what I'm saying is that this thing itself is gamma mu, gamma mu. And then the another copy will be gamma rho, gamma rho. Well, the reason I'm not squaring the entire thing is because it's too long to write. So basically what I'm saying is that when I square this, I basically get a gamma matrix with a different index, which will be contracted with the different index produced by squaring this. Okay, maybe it's the best if I strip off all the other things and just write down V bar gamma V bar three. See, it's hard to carry all those things around. Then let's just remember they do have momentum dependence, they do have a spin label. So let's do it properly. So there is u bar 1, u bar 1 gamma mu v 2, and then there is a v bar 3 gamma mu U4. All right, so all the momentum dependence and the spin labels have been stripped so that we can keep track both the contraction in the spinner index and the contraction in the gammas. Yeah, fair enough. So if I square this thing, but now I know how to do it. This says if you, well, I guess the first term doesn't change. This is just given by this. But when we square it, because it's taking the dagger, so we actually go backwards. So this is going to give me U4 bar gamma V, V bar gamma U. And the gamma acquires some new index rows.
V's in the middle are 3 and 2, I assume?
Right. I should, of course, keep their index. Otherwise, I'll never be able to go back. OK. So I guess we should pause here, because this is confusing and important. So what we did is we say, OK, write this thing square is going to be really hard. Let's look at it first. What we observe is this thing is a spinner. In spinner space, it's like it doesn't transform. This thing doesn't transform in spinner indices. But on the other hand, if you look at all the gamma and the eta, it doesn't have all the space-time indexes are contracted too. But of course, we are calculating a Lorentz scalar. So of course, it should be that in spinner indices and in space-time indices that they are all Lorentz scalar. So what did we do? The next step is figuring out how do I square something is a spinner scalar. It has all contracted a spinner, all the spinner indices contracted a thing without thinking too hard about the gamma yet. And then they realized it does very nicely. It switched the position, and because we need still to be spinner scalar, then the bar just naturally occur where it should. Then we realize, okay, but we do have to worry about the space-time indices, so let's just throw away all the momentum and the spinner index spin label, those polarization, and write that amplitude very compactly here. Then we just follow what we just discovered by inverting this whole thing. Yeah, now I just have this thing to worry about. We're good to go? Yeah? Okay. Now, what do we do is to restore this indices. Well, new cycle. Yeah. So this is some indices. And we have some momentum dependence, which are hidden. I'll just write this guy up. And there is the. Right? So this thing, I don't know how much I can teach you by squaring this again for you. You just have to square once by yourself. It's just this whole thing. You strip off all the indices, and then you write a thing that is reverse. It's really just writing the same thing in reverse order. And where it has to be barred, you bar it. Actually, it is reversed. You write it in the reverse order. If there is no bar, now it has bar. There's bar, there's no bar. Yeah?
Do we consider that the particles, the initial and the final?
Very good. Yeah. Right. This is what I'm going to talk about right now. Yes. People all worry about these spin labels. Indeed, we should worry. Because now if we know, so now they are not summed yet. But as I mentioned 2 days ago, or 1 day ago, well, experimentally, it's very hard to prepare all electrons line up, spin up. And it's also really hard, whatever come out of the collider. Like, it's already pretty hard to give a tag to the particle. Ah, I found this muon. And it's really, really hard to say this muon actually is spinning in some direction. So what we do, customarily do, is not calculate this. But then instead, we stick a factor of 1/4, says we're going to sum all the spin labels that ever show up, and then divide it by averaging, because this has two choices, so that's a half, and there's another half. And they were like, yay! Now we are summing all the spin labels. So because alternative choice, if somebody really doing an experiment with all the things measured, there's nothing we can do about this term. But now it does. Look at this term. Nicely turned into a spin sum. Isn't that wonderful? And so this you know how to do. This thing turns into P/+M. And then you have another pair. Then you have another pair. So you just turn them all into this P/+M, P/-M, blah, blah, blah. And the only thing you want to notice is, since now all the spin that has been restored, if you put this here, this produces another one. Then if you keep track of your index, you realize it's a cycle. So it's like HA will give you something like a P1/+M. And then you will have a gamma. Then you will have some other /-M, blah, blah, blah. Another gamma. Another one of this. But then it is a trace, because all your indexes form a cycle. And this is really how much I want to say, because you can open any book to check all the gamma traces, trace identities. They are not hard to prove. And we only really need two, because the homework stated very clearly says we're doing high energy collision, take electron to be massless. So a lot of term drop out. The only thing you need to calculate is like a P slash. There is. So this become, I think it's becoming two traces. There is one here, then there is the end, and then it starts again. So they become two traces, which you can just use trace identity. It's in any book, it's in the lecture notes. Then in the lecture notes, I'll follow this thing through. You have a very thorough example how this happens. That how the traces is calculated, you have, like, it looks very dizzy, but there's nothing tricky anymore. That those are just algebra, you have to do it once in your life. So if you look at lecture notes, you can follow through all the rest. And this is just two things I want to point it out, how to do a dagger of this, how this thing actually turns into a trace. But after that, it's just algebra. So I'll end the class here, but I want to advertise to QFT2. So I'll try to briefly tell you what's going to happen in the next course. In the first week, we'll learn the past integral formulation of the quantization. Especially when you encounter fermions, there's going to have Grassmann variables. Those are fun. They are just number, but they are somehow anti-commute. Well, the anti-commute has to show up somewhere. And the second week, roughly, we'll learn the dark magic of the renormalization. Remember all those infinities that we have swept underneath the carpet. Now we're going to try to justify it. You might still be not convinced, but we'll try to justify. And in the third week, we're going to learn even more forces. We learned about the electromagnetic force, and we'll learn the non-abelian gauge theory, which accounts for the other forces in our life. Well, not gravity. But I always wonder if the force is described by a gauge theory. But then I wouldn't know what's the force carrier. But I guess that's Jai Day. Okay, I'll end here.